history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you, and you never know what you might find out if you take the time to listen to a few of their stories. We do that each week here on Hometown Heroes. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're always entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Those stories are disappearing quickly, and I was reminded of that when I learned of the recent passing of George T. Joe Sicato. If you grew up in Denver, Colorado, he might have been your postman. He was as humble and unassuming a man as you'd ever find. But he was also a recipient of our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. I had the privilege of visiting him in his Colorado home in 2011, and I thought we'd honor him in this final program of 2015 by listening to his amazing tale. First things first, I had to start with the confusion over his first name.
Well, Dad would have called me Joe Taro. And he sees the paper G-E-O, and he says, oh, that's Joe. He gives that to the doctor, and the doctor gives the vital statistic. Looked at it, and he says, oh, that's abbreviation for George. So my birth certificate came out George, but all my life I've been called Joe. So I had to go into service as George instead of Joe. Everybody would say, who's George? I know Joe Sicato, but who's George Sicato?
So you've been Joe and George your whole life.
Right. So I've been answered to both George or Joe.
Well, I'll call you Joe. Let's go back in time now. You're growing up in Southern California, Colton, out in the Redlands, Ontario, Riverside kind of area of Southern California. And along comes December 7th, 1941, which you're about 20 years old at the time. What do you remember about that day and how you heard about what happened out on the islands?
We had a grocery store, a meat market in Redlands, California, and we opened the store up on Sunday, and the radio was on, Roosevelt was on, and it says Pearl Harbor was being bombed by the Japanese. And I says, oh my God, what are we going to be into now? So it's been a few months go by, and we had to move out of town or go to camps, relocation centers, they would call them. Barbed wire fence with guard towers on the corner with machine guns. That wasn't for us. We gave us 3 days to move. We sold the meat case for $300 and threw in the store. And the peddler that brought us our fruits and vegetables put everything we could on his pickup and drove us to Phoenix, Arizona. So we were on Phoenix, Arizona, we was on the south side of the tracks. We had to move the next north side of the tracks. And the farmer and rancher told us we could stay on the back porch of his house, and then we would work on his farm. So we worked on his farm, and after about a month of picking cantaloupes, I decided, well, I is either going to get out of here or whatever. I didn't want to be a farmer. The fellow offered me to work on his grocery store. So I worked in his grocery store, and the residents in the Postons and Gila River would come out and work on the farms and had to go back to camp.
So these are the Japanese Americans who were in the internment camps in Poston and Gila River, Arizona.
Right. They would come out to work on the farms. I was able to go visit them because they would order something and we would take it into the camps and visit the camps. The camps are tar paper roof and tar paper, everything. 110 degrees, sun shining on it. It's about 130 inside the space that they were. Each resident family had to stay in 10 by 20 room. And then you had your beds. If you had more than six in the family, if you had eight in the family, two of them would have to go back and stay with somebody else, live with somebody else that didn't have that many children.
Was it upsetting for you to see these people stuck in that situation in those conditions?
Bad, that was bad. And then I thought, well, this is not for me either. I think I'll join the Air Force. I signed up for the Air Force, and the draft card says 4C, enemy alien. I said, what do you mean enemy alien? I'm an American. I'm born and raised here. No, your draft card says 4C, can't take you. But it so happened that the 100th Battalion was Territorial Guards of Hawaii. They rounded them up and sent them to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, and took the basic training, went over to Africa to join General Mark Clark. And then they went into Sicily and went into Anzio, and Anzio to Mount Cassino. It was a church on top of a hill, and they were supposed to take that hill. It's a church, and they didn't want to bomb it. And every time they would go up, they would get shot. So they became known as the Purple Heart Battalion. General Mark Clark said, we need more soldiers like this. So then Roosevelt signed a decree that we could join the army. Therefore, the Force 2 was formed. All the residents volunteered from the camps, and then the Hawaiians and the pineapple fields came to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and became formed the 42nd Regimental Combat Team and went overseas to join the 100th Battalion in Italy. Then I said, well, I'm going to join the Air Force again, and I signed up for the Air Force and got to Camp Blanding, and I'm looking for the airplanes, and they, where's the airplanes? Whatever. No, you're not in the Air Force. You're in the infantry. The 100th Battalion's replacement. You're the replacement. So I became an infantryman.
So this was not by choice. And a lot of the guys that ended up in the 442nd volunteered to go there because their families were in internment camps and they wanted to prove that they were every bit as American as anybody else. That wasn't your motivation. You're trying to go in the Air Force. They say, wait a second, you're Japanese-American. We're sticking you with the rest of them. Is that pretty much how it happened?
That's how it happened. Mm-hmm. Says, you're a replacement, the 100th Battalion needs replacement. You're it. So I became an infantryman.
And how did you take that? Because I'm sure you'd heard about the kinds of things they were doing and the casualties that they'd suffered. I mean, the nickname Purple Heart Battalion kind of says it all, right?
Right. Hear the sound of that, and I said, oh, my gosh. I'm stuck here now. I was signed that I would go to war. Next thing I know, I was on board ship. My brother was a first draftee in 1939. He was drafted, and he was at Fort Ord, California, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And then he had to go back in to inland to Missouri area, and he had to take his basic training over again. So that's when I joined the Army. I had joined the first draftees, had their basic training. So I joined them, and we went to Camp Shelby, and from there we went overseas and joined. I joined the E Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Platoon, and then my brother was in, joined the 100th Battalion, became Baker Company. From there on, we went on board ships and headed for France. In France, we ended up in the near the Vosges Mountains of the Swiss border and the German border, foothills of the Swiss Alps, and climbing those hills is like 45-degree angle, and I had to pull on tree roots and pull myself up. Somebody else would take my pack, and somebody else. I was the last one up the hill, and when we got up top of the hill, this is going to be our first day of battle, and I was talking with one of my friends from Washington. We sat there, and we didn't know what incoming or outgoing was. When these veterans from the 442s of the 100 were fighting in Italy, they came back. I hear this. Oh, then the guy says, oh, that's outgoing. Okay, next. We're talking around, and then pretty soon, boom. I picked myself up about 15 feet, 10 feet away. I got a nick in my wrist, and then in my foot, I had another nick, but I looked down and see my friend laying down, face down, and I turned him over, and a shrapnel grazed his jugular vein, and the blood was squirting out every time his pulse was beat, or this stream of blood the size of a pencil would come out. And I'm trying to, my wound was nothing, so I was putting sulfur on his wound, and put a pad on it and putting it too hard, and he couldn't breathe. And I had to let go, and blood was still squirting out. He finally lost too much blood, and he was the first to die on me.
And that was your very first day of combat?
First day of combat. The other veterans, they knew what's going on. But for me to get blown up and then see something, So my friend squirting blood, bleeding. I couldn't help him without choking him. And then I said, well, this is not for me. I don't know what I'm doing here. But we had to go. So we finally had to climb this hill and moving forward to town of Brewers. And the 3rd Battalion was down the bottom in the valley heading for Brewers. And then we heard house-to-house combat. They were fixed bayonets. So as we was marching towards the other end of the hill, the explosion goes off the top of the ridge that we were following, landmines. So we had to get on our stomach and pull out our bayonets and probe for landmines on an inch by inch. What if I hit the trigger of the landmine? Holy mackerel. Boom. Another mine went off. Some of the top of the ridge. Well, we traveled on top of the ridge so we could look down to the left side and look down on the right-hand side. So as we traveled, they had these landmines put up. Then we finally got those out of the way, and then we got down to the end of the hill and we're looking down at this town of Brewers, and we see a tank, German Tiger tanks going out. Hooray, they're leaving. Then he got out in the middle of a field and he turns around, and that's funny, his barrel is facing us. Next thing I hear, boom. Then I see a ring of smoke on the end of the barrel of the tank, and then pow, hit the tree behind us. He was shooting at us. We had to run on the other side and try to dig in about 6 inches and hit tree roots and rocks. And I had to crawl into my helmet, and I said, what am I getting into now? Oh, my God. Then we finally took that hill, went to the next hill, took another hill, and we got another one. And we got up early in the morning, and they chased the Germans off this one hill. And I chased them all the way down to the bottom of the hill, and the sergeant says, come back. So I'm heading back, and the German is shooting at me, and I'm shooting back at him. And then I try to get back up the hill, and I go about 10 feet, and I got to rest. Go 10 more feet and rest. When I got on top of the hill, nobody was there. They thought I had joined them, and they all headed back downhill. Their eyes didn't know which way was our lines.
So you were all alone?
I was all alone by myself. And I got down, I got to the south end, the east end, left end of the hill, and I saw a big bush and 3 feet high, and I crawled inside that bush and put some branches on top of my face and nose. And I stayed there for a couple hours, and then German patrol comes by. Oh, my God. 2 more hours goes by. And I said, well, it's now 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I see our helmet, and I said, oh, that's hot. Hey, what company is this? The guy wanted to shoot me because I didn't know the password. I said, I've been up this hill for 6 hours, and I don't know where the password is now. They took me back and got down. As soon as I got down the hill, got the rest of the company. Captain says, 3rd platoon, you got to go up and see this colonel. Well, I just got to join the company. Well, you got to go. So we go up. One fellow was writing up a citation for that hill because we had taken that hill in 2 hours, an hour and a half. He was writing his 3rd platoon. So he had to join us. He put all the information in his pocket, and we get up to see this colonel, and the colonel says he wanted to see where his men were. This is the 36th Division, Texas unit, and they was a Howley outfit. And we go out and see somebody chopping wood on this side of the hill and somebody's chopping wood on the other side of the hill. And then we go up about 1,000 yards. Oh, sure enough, there's men were dug in, the foxholes and everything. Then the lieutenant there says, go see where the Germans are at. Why should we go see where the Germans are? Why can't they go see where the Germans are at? They didn't have orders. What do you mean they didn't have orders? So we go up, go another 500 yards, and German machine gun. We hit the ground. I rolled over to the left, got behind a bush. Guy from Pueblo, Colorado was on my left side. He was out in the open. Ben Masoka was writing up a citation. He was on my right side of my. He was out in the open. And the guy named Friday on the other side of him, he was out in the open. George put up on our left side. He looked up, first one to get to. A sniper, German sniper, had telescopic sights with crosshair. Pow! Right through the temple. First one to go. Then Ben on the other side, he didn't have his helmet strapped on. Pow! He increased his temple. Blood just come out, and then the helmet flew right way back. Then Friday, he looks up. He got shot. So all three guys got shot and looking for me, and I'm behind this bush, and he couldn't see me. I had to go back, and I, for just to see where the their own troops were, we had to go and find where the Germans were. We get shot. We lose three men just for nothing.
So it sounds like the message that you're getting is you guys were expendable.
That's what we were. General Dahlquist was, kept pushing, you got to move, you got to move. That's why the 141st unit, the Lost Battalion, got surrounded because they went too fast. They were moving too fast, and the rest of the 142nd and 43rd could not rescue them. So it was up to 442 to rescue the Lost Battalion.
And we'll learn more about the Lost Battalion when we come back from our first break. In this final episode of 2015, we're listening to the story of Medal of Honor recipient Joe Sicato, who passed away this month at the age of 94. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.